We don't need your help. We deal with our own problems here, and we don't need you hanging around telling us what to do in our own cities and towns that our forefathers built with their own hands.
Welcome to Meridians.
Welcome to Meridians. I'm Charlie Noble. Today I'm talking about Benjamin Franklin in Philadelphia. I'll cover his time living there as well as his time living in England. No ceremony is needed. If you're ready, I'm ready. Here goes. In the previous episode, I mostly focused on Benjamin Franklin's teen years while he was working for his brother James at his print shop in Boston. He had a falling out with him after basically catfishing him in his own newspaper, the New England Courant. He was a made-up woman named Silence Duguid. It's kind of a catfishing in a way. But there were some other reasons as well why he left. But you'll have to just look at the other episode for that. But we left off when he arrived in Philadelphia. And having traveled only a few hundred miles from Boston to Philadelphia, Franklin found himself a bit in a culture shock. There was apparently immediately a sort of language barrier when he was trying to order some food. Really, it was just a terminology thing. He wasn't accustomed to the local currency or local customs for buying bread, and this must have made for some culture shock for the young man. After all, he didn't know anyone in town and found out pretty quickly that he was kind of out of his element. I imagine that he was a bit discouraged by this, just trying to buy bread. How was he expected to write, communicate, and print news for the public if he didn't understand the language? Some tough times seemed to be ahead for him. Now to remind you, dear listener, Franklin came to Philadelphia on a tip that William Bradford's son, Andrew Bradford, might have been in need of some help in his print shop. So Franklin caught up with this Andrew fella to seek employment. But he was turned down again, only to be directed towards another printer again, this time named Samuel Keimer. So Keimer was a British fellow who learned the printing trade in London, the same place where James Franklin had learned the trade. The printing trade was really booming there, and Keimer opened his own print shop in the borough of Southwark, London, in 1713. So he was going to make it big, you know, like all these other big printers in London. It's a new big industry, but he wasn't good with his finances. And also he had these Protestant views that were shining through in his news. That might have worked over in New England, in the colonies, where all of his potential readers had kind of ended up, but not in London. He also was terrible with money. So this landed Keimer in debtor's prison. And these debtors' prisons, they just kind of sound like Orwellian nightmares. I mean, sometimes even an entire family would live together in this prison to pay off these debts. I mean, it's kind of yikes. Not the kind of thing you want to ever hear coming back. So eventually, Keimer did get himself out of debtors' prison, and he managed to book passage to America. Well, not so fast. They were still the British colonies at the time, but there he goes anyway. He made his way to Philadelphia in 1723 and opened up another print shop, just in time for our protagonist, young Benjamin Franklin, to show up. So what a wonderful fate that these two were brought together just when they needed each other. Franklin quickly showed Keimer that he knew what he was doing with a printing press and that he immediately got to work helping him. Keimer was not doing much better in Philadelphia before Franklin showed up. His printing press was barely working. So soon Franklin became Keimer's foreman and started getting the newspaper in shape. He's only 17 years old, but he's smart as a whip and he knows what he's doing. It's not long before Franklin writes letters in Keimer's paper himself. So then the governor of Pennsylvania reads one of these letters. Governor William Keith. He reads one of Franklin's letters and he's impressed by his writing. I mean, Franklin was really a really good writer. So the governor then takes Franklin sort of under his wing, sort of. A shout out to William Keith. You know, the guy, he knows how to pick him. Sure. So upon the urging of Keith, Franklin traveled to London in 1724 to gain contacts in the printing industry, purchase equipment, and learn more about his trade. He would spend 18 months in London. The governor thought Franklin should start his own print shop. And what a great guy, right? He identified talent in this young man and wanted to invest in his future. It definitely wasn't so that Keith would have an extremely intelligent printer on his side in Philadelphia to support him politically in the future. There's no way that was his motive, right? Well, to be fair, it could be both. And that's kind of the impression I'm getting here, but not so fast, Governor. Before Franklin could even return from London, Keith was removed from office. He had offended the very person who was in charge of appointing him in the first place and got himself kicked out of office. And as a reminder from the last episode, governors were appointed and not elected. So that was about it for him. So Franklin's benefactor is now kind of in the dumps and he's back in need of employment. Eventually, Franklin becomes the manager of Keimer Printing House, but he declined it at first. Exactly how messed up was this printing house that a 19-year-old declined it to be the manager? Well, it's because he had gotten to know a shop owner while he was in England, and he came back to manage his shop and to help this shop owner out. But then this goods store that he was helping out with, the owner dies, and so Franklin then does accept the offer to be the manager of Keimer's Printing House, as it was called. And so then Franklin starts working these long hours at Keimer, and he's clearly making the place continue to function, but it sounds rough. Like Keimer's, you know, he's probably just a thorn in his side. Keimer tries to cut Franklin's wages because they're struggling financially. So Franklin just takes a walk. He quits. And you know what? Keimer goes broke again. And guess who manages to swoop in and buy the printing press out from under Keimer? Well, Franklin himself does. Of course, with the help of a friend named Meredith. Hugh Meredith was another employee at Keimer's printing house, but he's sort of an odd duck to be working there. He was an Oxford-educated man who basically ended up as an indentured servant. His family was wealthy, but he was terrible at managing his money and You know, Franklin's just in the right place at the right time. He happens to have a rich friend. So I don't want to call it, you know, I shouldn't say a friend is kind of an opportunity, but Franklin and Meredith kind of saw a solution to their own problems and they bought up Keimer's printing press. Keimer got bailed out. Franklin was back to work and Meredith was no longer working a job that was lower than his station. We're doing air quotes there. So just to recap, Franklin has gone through a lot in Philadelphia in his short time. He found a printer who is in bad need of help, and he lands a job almost immediately. He gets noticed by the local governor almost immediately, who then helps him go to London to get more training and connections in the printing industry. And now he's got a wealthy friend whose goals align with his own. And now he owns his own print shop. Not a bad start in Philly, Mr. Franklin. But it seems to happen, as it seems to happen, the financing that Meredith's father had promised to provide, it just never came. And this caused Franklin to borrow money from a couple of other friends to buy out Meredith's ownership of the print business. And now Franklin can become the sole owner of the print shop. Franklin must have had a lot of charisma to make all these friends, and then be entrusted with all this money. He must have just impressed the people who was around him. So, and this newspaper that he took over, it was the Pennsylvania Gazette. Now, Franklin could write all the letters to the editor he wanted to now, with as many pseudonyms as he wished. And he did. The paper's quality improved greatly under Franklin's ownership. He grew the paper's subscribers exponentially, and he did it by keeping the paper in more of a neutral stance. And he probably could do that because, you know, well, he just writes a letter to the editor with one of these pseudonyms, and it's like, well, that was somebody else's stance, you know, and he could kind of keep the paper sort of on this neutral footing. So this is sort of weird. He's only 22 years old, right? And he's acquired the printing business from Keimer. It just feels incredibly young to be writing your own newspaper. I gotta say, this day and age, if there was like a 22-year-old that had this really successful newspaper, I feel like he'd be really well known. And I think Franklin was in Philadelphia because his paper becomes so popular. But then he gets much more popular because he's not just satisfied with writing a newspaper periodical. He creates an almanac called Poor Richard's Almanac in 1732. And this was also written under a pseudonym, in this case, Richard Saunders, or Poor Richard. The almanac was an annual publication that had a calendar, weather predictions, I'm sure those were super accurate, astronomical and astrological information, poems, literature excerpts, puzzles, recipes, and trivia. It was like a little internet before the internet, you know, that you got annually. Oh, and the almanac also had witty phrases in it. And here are some of my favorites, because Franklin is very famous for all of his witty phrases. So, a friend in need is a friend indeed. And I'm sure that one was close to Franklin's heart, having been financially saved by friends to be able to publish that very phrase. And then there's another one. Well done is better than well said. Holy hell, if the folks on the internet could read that now. There's a whole lot of people doing a lot of well saying without a lot of well doing. You know what I mean? So it's probably one of my favorite quotes, honestly. But here's another one. Love your enemies, for they will show you your faults. I kind of like that one because it really reminds me of those like Buddhist teachings, if you're familiar with that at all, about like loving the people who are difficult to you because they help you practice patience. It's a very weird concept, but it's a very, very Buddhist concept. Anyway, Poor Richard's Almanac sold incredibly well. Franklin would go on to print this almanac for 25 years. In some years, the print runs were up to 10,000 copies per year. That's really successful. But he printed more than just that. Franklin's print shop was very busy. In 1730, after writing an essay on the need for paper money, get this, Franklin impressed the legislature as they saw his publication on paper money as being very helpful to their cause. As a result, his print shop was rewarded by being made the official printer for the Pennsylvania government. He would print votes and proceedings for the assembly, laws, and yeah, he printed paper money. I love it. I declare that we need more paper money. Hey, he's right. Let's have him print some more money. Literally, that's kind of how it went. So Franklin certainly knew how to catch the wind here. Besides that, though, Franklin's print shop also printed periodical pamphlets and some general use forms. So he's clearly off and running in the print business. But one other thing that he would start to publish in his newspaper was his scientific research. Franklin had been interested in science for most of his life, really. And in 1727, he actually formed a debate club in Philadelphia called the Junto, J-U-N-T-O is how it's spelled. I think it's Junto, in which the members discussed various topics, including philosophy and scientific concepts. As Franklin got older, he then had more and more free time as well. His printing business made him a fairly wealthy man, a man with a lot of free time. So in 1748, Franklin is now 42 years old. He takes on a partner named David Hall, who took over the day-to-day operations of the printing business. Franklin was now a man firmly middle-aged, a man that had all the free time in the world. Sounds great. And I'm avoiding Franklin's personal life here mostly, but I will say this. I just want to paint the picture for what his life is like now that he's in his 40s. Franklin actually had courted a girl when he was 17 and she was 15 named Deborah Reed. And Franklin later proposed to Deborah, but her mother wouldn't allow it because Franklin was about to leave for that trip to London. And so Deborah ends up marrying this guy named Rogers while he's gone. Well, Franklin's gone. And this Rogers guy turns out to be a deadbeat, and he just disappears on her, and she's suddenly alone again. Then, after Franklin returns from London, he resumes his relationship with Deborah, but Deborah was still technically married to this Roger guy, which they can't find him. You know, he just disappeared. So Franklin and her can't actually get married legally. So in 1730, they simply entered into a common law marriage. Franklin also had an illegitimate son named William at some point here, and apparently the mother is simply unknown, which is kind of odd, but it's not Deborah's child. But props to her, she raises the child as her own. She seems like a good lady. And as a side note, this son would end up growing up to be a British loyalist and be a giant disappointment to Franklin. But anyway, so Franklin does have a family. He's a middle-aged man with plenty of free time, though, still. And in 1749, Franklin started to observe that lightning had many similarities to electricity. Aren't we all just sitting here going, well, yeah, like, isn't that kind of obvious? So, but anyway, that, I mean, it's kind of hard to, it, when you've grown up knowing lightning was always electricity, it's kind of hard to be like, well, yeah, duh, you know, but anyway, so they both created light. Obviously, they both produced loud crashes, and they were attracted to metals. This led him to hypothesize that lightning was just a form of electricity. Pretty straightforward. He spent a lot of time researching electricity then, and he would use Leyden jars for some of his experiments. And these were recently developed, just within like 5 years that he started using them. He used them to conduct electrical experiments. So Leyden jars are an early form of capacitor. And a capacitor is simply a device that can temporarily store an electric charge. It does this by having two conductive metals separated by something that can't conduct electricity, so like an insulator, like glass or I think ceramic is one that was used a lot. So when voltage is applied, a positive and negative charge builds up on opposite sides of the insulating plate, and an electrical field is formed between the two, and it kind of stores the charge. A Leyden jar is, so it's a type of capacitor. It would typically be a jar that's lined with metal foil on the inside, partway up at least, and then a metal rod passes through an insulating stopper and makes contact with the inner metal foil. The jar itself is then the insulator, and a charge is applied to the inside and outside of the jar, storing static electricity. So this allowed people like Franklin to conduct experiments more easily. These Leyden jars were really a pretty, you know, like I said, they were a new invention. They were independently invented in 1745, which is kind of interesting that two guys in two places invented basically the same thing. It's interesting how often things like that seem to happen in history. But, you know, it feels like the entire 18th century was a great time to be like an electricity enthusiast. Everything I keep reading about all of these, there's a lot of people conducting research in electricity at this time. So now let's talk about the kite experiment of Benjamin Franklin, the thing he's probably most known for. This happened in 1752, and here's all he did. He took a kite and then attached a hemp string to it. Yes, the devil's lettuce, hemp. Hemp was used quite a bit back then. Even his newspaper would probably have had hemp fibers in it, I guess. Anyway, the hemp string would be tied to a key down on the ground, and when the kite was flown, the rain made the hemp wet and also made it conductive. So the ambient charge in the atmosphere would pass into the kite and the string and make the hemp fibers sort of stand on end, which would certainly have been recognized as electrical activity by Franklin. Certainly everyone back then was familiar with static electricity, like with their hair standing up. That's not like some new invention, right? So when Franklin used a Leyden jar and connected the key to this Leyden jar, he could collect all this electricity into the Leyden jar, which is kind of neat. And this proved that lightning was electricity. And Franklin would, that's it. That's all he did. And Franklin would be immortalized for this. And he didn't actually get the kite struck by lightning or anything. It was all just that ambient charge from the storm that would prove his point. So naturally, Franklin published these findings in his newspaper. And as a result of this experiment, he received the Copley Medal from the British Royal Society for his work on electricity. This medal was a pretty big deal, and it cemented Franklin as a scientist. And by the fact that the British Royal Society is hearing about it and giving him a medal, you can kind of tell that this news kind of made it all the way over to London and kind of made it all over the world, this information that he's passing around. After all, he is a printer. He can print all the news he wants and send it all the everywhere he wants to send it. So he'd also continue to prove other theories and publish findings. The kite experiment sort of directly led to the invention of the lightning rod. This too would contribute to his growing celebrity. Franklin put the first lightning rod in his own house. The idea was that the electricity would travel the most efficient path to the ground. Metal being more efficient than air, or wood, would protect the homes and really churches, because they're the tallest structure in the area usually, at the time anyway, and it'd protect them from fires, from lightning strikes. And he, of course, published the findings of his lightning rods, and then it became extremely popular across America and Europe, and he's now on his way to becoming one of the most famous people on Earth. He would soon be this household name. And he's, you know, he's in his, like, what, mid-40s at this point? And his newspapers made him sort of famous. You know, his almanac made him fairly famous. But his lightning rod invention and the kite experiment, I mean, it made him one of the most famous people ever. He was kind of like He was kind of like Stephen Hawking, let's say that. He's like the Stephen Hawking of his time, or the Mother Teresa of his time, or something like that. That's better. So out of his research, Franklin wrote a book called Experiments and Observations on Electricity. I actually had mentioned this book in episode 7 of the podcast, I think. Alessandro Volta had read it, and he's kind of the granddaddy of electricity. Well, I guess Franklin is the, you could say Franklin is the grandfather of electricity, and Volta is the father of electricity. He's the one that actually fathered the child. So now the now that Franklin is famous, he starts getting asked for favors by the Pennsylvania Assembly, as, you know, naturally, as one would. The local government at the time is this Pennsylvania Assembly, and so it's like a local legislature. I mean, this is a bit more than a favor they're asking. They're hoping he'll help the assembly with a problem of the authority of the British government. And this problem really started with the founding of their own legislation and the arrival of William Penn, whom the colony was named after because he founded the colony in 1681. And he was also the appointed governor at that time. This is the same dynamic that I briefly mentioned in the last episode. There's a governor who's been appointed by the British Crown. In this case, it was a rich Quaker man named William Penn. Then there's the Pennsylvania Assembly, which is elected by local leaders in the communities of the colony. So by 1756, William Penn is long dead, but his family was still in charge of Pennsylvania. Thomas Penn, William Penn's son, was technically the governor of Pennsylvania in 1756, but he was in England, and he had a deputy governor running this and the colony on his behalf. So William Denny was this governor, this deputy governor, and he had a pretty horrible job. He kind of feels like a guy that just, you know, here, you work for me. Everybody's going to yell at you, but they're not going to yell at me, so it's your problem. And he's, you know, Thomas Penn is safely tucked away in England, sending orders over to the colonies and over the colony, really. And Denny had to be the guy to carry out these orders. So one such issue was that, oh, did I mention that Pennsylvania was at war in 1756, technically? The French and Indian War. British troops were stationed to protect the colonies from French and French-allied Native American forces. So a quartering act was declared and carried out under the authorization of Denny. who answered to Thomas Penn in England, in turn answered to the King of England. And this quartering act, it required colonial assemblies to find money to pay for housing, supplies, and provisions for these British troops to quarter them, you know? And this would be one of those great examples of taxation without representation. Suddenly, all these troops were present in Pennsylvania. They didn't answer to anyone there but the British authority, who was back in England, and it was seen as yet another slight against the autonomy of the colonies. This resistance to the British troops being present was felt throughout the colonies, too. At first, I couldn't kind of understand why, to be fair. These settlements were under threat from French and Indian forces, right? Shouldn't they be glad to get help from the British army? I was really trying to get inside the mind of the colonists with this, you know, to understand. But I think, you know, here's the way I think it kind of plays out for the typical colonists of the time. So the British troops come in and they say, "We're here to stop the French and Indian forces by order of the king. You must give us supplies, food, and shelter." And then the colonists, who definitely wouldn't also have a pretty much British accent, were like, "We don't need your help. We deal with our own problems here, and we don't need you hanging around telling us what to do in our own cities and towns that our forefathers built with their own hands. We've been fighting and dealing with the indigenous forces for generations, and we know the land better than any Frenchman. Get out. We got this." So, you know, they probably thought, for good reason, that they built these colonies. They know how to handle themselves. And I think I've painted a fairly good picture of what's going on at the time that they need Franklin to intervene and go on this mission. Since the real authority was in England and Benjamin Franklin was a very famous, distinguished figure in the Pennsylvania community, it was only natural for the Pennsylvania Assembly to ask him to go to England and speak on their behalf. So Franklin went to England in 1757, and this was no short trip. He'll be there for quite a while. I was kind of surprised, but if you think about it, it takes weeks to get there back then. It's not like you're going to turn around right away and come home. Not like we do now. But he even brought his son with him and two slaves as well. Yeah, I just hated reading that, but it's... Yeah, Franklin had slaves. I don't know how to rectify that in my mind. You know, there's no moral justification for this in our day and age, but Franklin's life is so historically significant, we can't just be like, well, he's an asshole. I don't really want to read or talk about him. We might as well close all your history books then, right? You can't really talk about him. If it doesn't sort of dry up any admiration for him, though, maybe this will. So while he brought his own son with him, he left his wife and daughter back in the colonies while he was in England, for whatever reason. So he replaced his wife and daughter, sort of, with his landlady, Margaret Stevenson, and her daughter, Polly. He was staying at their house in England. So for a man who seemed to care a lot about virtue and morals, here he is. He's left his wife and daughter behind. He brought two slaves with him, and he's shacking up with some lady named Margaret. And it just doesn't seem like a very virtuous man from where I'm sitting, you know? I could morally skewer just about anyone in history, couldn't we all? It doesn't really help communicate the past, though, does it? It gets old sitting here going, well, yeah, he's so terrible because of this, and this. Anyway, here's what he did. You know, we could go on and on with every character in history doing that, but I think it's important to bring up from time to time so that people don't get the wrong... So people don't get the idea that these were just these highfalutin, morally superior people. Like, a lot of people seem to treat the founding fathers of the United States like they're these holy men or something. They're just guys. Most of them were young, 30-year-old, 20 to 30-year-old, 40-year-old men. They weren't these wise old sages that were ever virtuous and didn't do anything wrong. And man, they came up with all these ideas themselves. None of that's true. They had all kinds of help coming up with these ideas, and most of them weren't original ideas anyway. But, you know, they deserve the credit that they get. They they did found a very important democracy, whatever. So anyway, Thomas Penn finds out about Franklin's plans, and immediately he's not receptive to his mission. I mean, no surprise, part of Franklin's mission was to undermine their control of Pennsylvania. I wonder if he really thought this was going to work in the first place. Franklin was trying to suggest some financial solutions that would kind of appease the British authority, but also appease the Pennsylvania Assembly. So just kind of an alternative plan with that kind of gave the Assembly more control over the way they raised taxes. They wanted to raise the taxes themselves, be in control of it. They just wanted more autonomy. So Franklin kind of was unsuccessful in this endeavor he was sent to London to fulfill. But he personally would have just like a great time there, it sounds like. He got to know the scientific community, became involved in their social circles. You know, he's a famous guy. He probably walks around and everybody's just falling all over him, you know, with compliments and wanting to talk to him and get in his ear. So he ends up staying there. So remember, he got there in 1757. He doesn't leave till 1762. And then he goes back to the colonies finally. He's really committed to his marriage, isn't he? So only a few years later, Franklin is then again asked to go back to London. I really wonder how his wife felt about that. And he still didn't bring her with. He left her behind again. But it's, you know, he did leave his son back home because his son was now the governor of New Jersey. But anyway, so Franklin spends his second trip trying to actually get the colonies under direct British control. Yeah, you heard that right. He wasn't trying to get more autonomy this time. He just wanted to cut out the Penn family because he thought they were just, he didn't like the way they were handling things. He thought it would be better under direct British authority, the crown itself. And, you know, so while Franklin is in England, then things do not go well. Franklin, it's really not going well back in the colonies, though, and Franklin's kind of hearing about it. The Stamp Act was enacted while he was in London. And the Stamp Act is this whole thing. It taxed a whole bunch of stuff back in the colonies, and they didn't have any say in it. It really pissed him off. It's often cited as one of the biggest drivers or one of the biggest drivers of the American Revolution. You know, it's just, again, they don't want taxation without any representation. I don't know. They had to be just belting that until they were blue in the face and the British authorities were just like turning their nose up or whatever. Sorry, British people. I know the stiff upper lip or whatever. They get accused of being uppity or whatever. I don't really get it. But so Franklin is not going to get anywhere. You know, this tension is building in the colonies in his absence while he's in England. And then the monarchy changes and the leadership in England, just they get even more hostile to the colonies. And then in 1774, Franklin's wife dies, but he doesn't go home. He doesn't go. I mean, obviously, he's not going to go back for the funeral. It would take weeks. It's just, you just didn't do that back then. It just was impractical, you know? So it wasn't really a reason to go home, but still kind of sad. But he stayed another year, basically, until 1775, at which time he had to quickly leave because things were really starting to heat up. And a lot of anti-colonial sentiment was happening, and he was worried about getting arrested. So he kind of just had to run out of there as quickly as he could. And of course, we know the Revolutionary War would break out soon thereafter. And, you know, that whole story would continue there. You know, that's Franklin's life then, up to the Revolutionary War. I know it wasn't quite the, like, you know, it didn't end on a, like, real big note. Maybe I should have restructured the story so it ended on some victory, but you know, we all know what he did after this, right? Like, he was involved in the Declaration of Independence, and then the war broke out. He went to France. You know, he was trying to get King Louis's support, and if he could get him to stop playing with his keys for 5 minutes. But that's our story today. I mean, I had a lot of fun learning about Franklin, and, you know, I knew a lot of this stuff. A lot of us know a lot of these things about Franklin. I hope I added a little bit of detail, a little more context to his life, you know, because a lot of this stuff, it's just, you know, you hear about, okay, Franklin went to France. I knew he went to London. I knew he did that kite thing. I knew he was this printer. When did he do all this stuff? I knew about the Silence Do Good stuff, but it's like, he just spent, I mean, basically all of his life is famous, right? There's hardly any times in his life where, oh, you know, he just kind of did his own thing. Honestly, the time where he went to London was probably one of the more mundane times, sort of, because he wasn't like super successful in making anything happen, right? So where do we go from here then? I know I said I was going to switch topics after this episode, and because we're not going to stick with Franklin. I thought, you know, maybe I could talk about the Revolutionary War, but I think that's kind of been done to death. And honestly, there's great podcasts out there for that. We're more interested in finding the quirky things and we're going to travel the world and try to look at things from a different perspective. So I thought, you know, if Franklin's going to London, I think he went to London 3 times in the last 2 episodes. So I think we'll head over there instead. You know, it's such an important city in history. I think next week we'll be taking a look at London, maybe during the Enlightenment, and particularly in the next episode, maybe the Enlightenment. And I'm really curious I want to look into what life was like in London at different levels of society, just to like really paint a thorough picture of what London and really England was like during the American Revolution. You hear about all this stuff that's going on in the colonies, but I never learned a whole lot about what was going on over in England. They had plenty of things going on over there too. And, you know, they're consistently at war with France. And, you know, what was it like to be a poor person there at the time? What were your rights? What were you doing? What were you spending your day doing? What was it like to be a merchant? You know, what was it like to be an aristocrat or like a royal? So I kind of want to, you know, maybe take like a bit of a snapshot of history. It might be a little bit of a different episode because I've done 2 episodes where I'm basically following somebody's life. I don't want to just make this be like a biography podcast. So we'll take a more broad look at London and then we'll go from there. I'm not sure if I'm going to spend more than 1 episode on London or not, but we'll see, you know. So anyway, it should be fun. So thank you so much for listening. As always, check the episode description for more details and give any feedback, even a correction. I'll definitely read a correction if I get any. I'm sure I misunderstood something or misplaced a minor date here or there. There's probably somebody like jumping out of his chair right now about some detail about Franklin or the kind of key he used for the kite or something like that. I'd love to hear from you. I will definitely make any and all relevant corrections. If it's like, well, he was actually wearing like a gray suit and it was really important, or he was actually the first to wear the tan suit. He actually made the tan suit work, but the tan suit didn't go over well in London. Yeah. If you know, you know. So anyway, have a good weekend. Have a good week, because this comes out on Sunday. Have a good week. Thank you so much for listening. This has been Meridians. I'm Charlie Noble. I'll see you next time.